Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Gene DiNardo. It is Thursday, November 8th, 2012, and almost seems pointless to say what the headlines are this week because there's really only one headline, and that headline is the election cycle is over. Hooray! But we should spend some time talking about that. We'll also be talking about some interesting pieces that have come about as a result of the LIBOR manipulation scandal that continues to go on. And we're going to take a look at a particular topic that Gene dug into regarding KBR, the defense contractor, and how they basically lost a lawsuit to National Guardsmen. Very significant thing there. Plus a rather humorous article that I found about how gold is at risk of being flooded in lower Manhattan. So we'll get to that one toward the end. And we'll also take a look at the United States fiscal cliff, which is the next topic of discussion on all the major policymakers' lips now that the election cycle is over. But it was a fairly nondescript election this time around. I mean, it was close, but I don't think anything really played out the way it wasn't supposed to. I mean, I don't know about you, Gene. I was able to pick all 50 states, and it wasn't too difficult. All you had to do was read the polls, pick the winner according to those polls, and make a little bit of a shift for the fact that Obama was doing a little bit of a surge toward the end, and you got it right. I mean, how difficult is that?
Well, that's interesting. And I read one article that referenced how the polls affected people, so you kind of wonder about that. But, yeah, it did kind of play out, although I did read a lot of stuff and hear a lot of stuff in the media about perhaps a popular vote going to Romney. And you know, at the beginning when they were for the first few hours of the coverage, it was going that way. But it ended up, I think, Obama actually had the popular vote by 3 million. Is that true? Something like that?
Sounds about right. I didn't follow it that closely, but that sounds about right.
You know what I thought was funny about the whole issue is you have the two parties, one... If it would have went that way, which it didn't, the popular vote did go to Obama. But you have the Democratic Party, which, of course, stands for the Democratic-style government. And actually, Obama won through the Electoral College, which is a Republic form of government. If he would have lost the popular vote, it would have been kind of interesting to have Republicans, you know, perhaps crying out for a Democratic election.
That's sort of a reverse of 2000, huh?
It's exact reverse. That was a bit. Was that one closer, the popular vote?
Yeah, it was pretty close. I don't remember what the numbers were, but it was really, really close.
The other interesting thing is which state is having problems again? But Florida.
What a surprise that was, I tell you.
Yeah, they either need to get it together or kind of... Let things happen as they should or something to that effect.
You know, the funny thing is I saw a note that said that they were going to finish the voting count in Miami-Dade today, and I still haven't seen any reference to what those final numbers are. So
Maybe they're working late in the evening. And that's the same county, isn't it? Isn't that the big county that was at issue last time?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a very Democratic oriented county, lots of blue collar, lots of minorities, and it was really the only major county left by the time election evening had worn on, so that it was clear that Romney couldn't really catch Obama on that one.
Yeah, and he kind of waited there till the last minute. He was worried, I think, about Ohio. Now you're in Virginia or West Virginia?
I'm in Virginia.
Okay, now
I'm in one of the swing states.
Oh, man, you have to be tired by now.
I'm tired of picking up the phone is what I am.
Yeah, picking up the phone. We did not see a commercial. And, you know, both Oregon and Washington apparently were decided long ago. So since we're close to the border and we share the same news stations, we would have been blasted on the TV even if, like, Washington was a swing state and we weren't. So, you know, it was just... I think, you know, I really feel sorry for people in swing states. It must have been something. But we didn't have to deal with that. We just had to deal with the local stuff.
Well, especially in the last few days, I mean, it got to the point where both on our home line and on my business phone line, the phone would ring approximately every 15 to 30 minutes.
Jeez.
And it would be a pollster. And it would be an automated pollster. You couldn't even tell anybody off. That was the worst part.
Yeah, you couldn't give them. So was that do they have the 5-second delay? Because what I do now, I just hang up.
Really, I don't really know. I just got frustrated and hung up. I didn't bother.
Yeah, right. No, if I hear the 5 second, I know it's either somebody selling something or, you know, in the election times, it's the election. So I don't even listen anymore.
It does vary. I mean, you're right. Sometimes you can tell that it's something other than, you know, mom calling.
Yeah, hang up on your mom. To tell you who to vote for.
The best part was when, after getting, you know, these hordes of calls from the Republican National Committee and re-elect Obama and all the special interest groups who are running their special stuff, that I finally got a call from Rachel of Card Services.
Rachel of Card.
And you heard about Rachel, didn't you?
Yeah, I heard. I read the article.
Yeah, Rachel got shut down. Well, at least temporarily shut down.
I didn't hear that.
Well, it's a funny thing. I actually wrote about it on the Nolan Chart. If you get a chance to take a look at it, it's kind of humorous. But the FTC was basically, they put together a contest. They put together a contest because the people who do these phone spamming operations, trying to, you know, get you to switch your you know, set up your insurance for your credit cards for them, all that kind of thing, and they just make a little money off of that kind of stuff. But anyway, the people who do that, they hide through all different kinds of twisted connections and so forth. I mean, when you get a call from Rachel at Card Services, you're getting it through like 25 different relays,
right?
And all of them are, you know, like firewalls and proxies and so forth to make it as impossible as it can be
to trace
back and figure out who they are. So the FTC, in their infinite foolishness, decided to put out a contest. I think they started in March of this year, in which they were basically offering a reward to anyone who could come up with a way to track down and prosecute these people. And I'm thinking, really? I mean, you really think it's that difficult? So I actually went through, and I entered the contest. I mean, I have no illusions that I'm going to win this thing.
But it was a great idea, I thought.
Well, they're going to award somebody who comes up with, you know, some sort of $50 million plan to do it.
Uh-huh.
But my proposal didn't actually cost $50 million. My proposal was a lot cheaper than that. What I proposed was, there are literally hundreds of thousands of people who complain every year about Rachel at Card Services to the FTC. Well, all you have to do is just take, you know, a bunch of these people and ask them, would you be willing to be a volunteer?
Yep, you got it.
So you'd be a volunteer, and we'll give you a credit card to use so that when they call you, you can say, well, this is my credit card number, and you can buy whatever crazy service that they're offering. And then when they buy that service, we have a financial record of it.
And then you
so
can trace it,
instead of
trying
to follow all through this maze of Internet protocol connections, all you have to do is just follow the money.
Right. This is similar to that's what they do in the Medicare fraud investigations, you know, and they even have a hard time doing that because they shut their doors so quickly, you know, because they're on to what the investigators are doing. But, yeah, that's a great idea. It's simple. You follow the money. And
it's not easy for these guys to shut their doors, though. I mean, literally, they had figured out that they were running from 5 separate major call centers around the country.
Oh, you know, kidding.
You know, so it's not like this was like, you know, Joe Mafia off in the corner making phone calls.
But it was only five networks, basically.
5 call centers. They were the combined effort of Rachel from Card Services.
And did they bust them and shut them down?
They didn't bust them. They got a temporary restraining order against them that temporarily shut them down while they figure out what the hell they're going to charge them with.
Yeah, and I imagine the people working there just think it's just any other job, you know. I'm sure they don't.
They probably have nothing. You know, they have no knowledge. They just hired minimum wage and, you know, making a few phone calls and seeing if they can pay the bills with it.
Yeah, the telephone's an interesting.
They can collect a phone call from Rachel at Card and Services.
The telephone's an interesting issue as far as freedoms and invasion of privacy and all that. When you think about it, because, you know, it's a public. Your number is public, basically, and accessible. And, you know, where you draw the line is, you know, it's up for debate, really. I say don't let any of them call. Or you should have the option, you know. I mean, why don't we have that option?
Well, we do tend to go far afield here, and we actually were originally talking about the election, so we should
go
back to that.
That is an important thing, isn't it?
So getting back to the election, I don't remember if we talked about this point in particular. Maybe you can remind me whether we actually brought this up, but I found an article that had appeared in Rolling Stone at the end of August, and I don't remember us talking about it, but it was really interesting. I found it just a couple days before the election, and it's about Mitt Romney. It's entitled Greed and Debt, the True Story of Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. Oh. And what I found particularly interesting was what the theme of the article was. I won't read the whole thing because, as you know, Rolling Stone articles go on for pages and pages. And,
they need
a broadsheet, so we're talking, you know, 25,000 words for an article. But like a quarter of a book.
Yeah, they got some good articles. They go on and on.
Well, it depends who you talk to as to whether or not the articles are good.
I think. Right.
I was having an email debate with Mark Vogel. You know who Mark is. He's a...
Oh, I bet that was an interesting debate.
I'm glad you had it. I cited the Rolling Stone article. He wouldn't look at it.
Okay. Because it was in the Rolling Stone?
Yeah, because all the people at Rolling Stone are drug users.
Well, that sums up just about every writer in the United States. No. I take that back. Okay,
but,
anyway.
It was funny. It was a funny exchange. I should send you the email sometime just so you can see him. But anyway, I finally did get him to look at it. And when he looked at the article, his response was, I'll have to get back to you on this one. He couldn't come up with an off-the-cuff response. Because here's what the article says. I'll read like the first couple paragraphs. Well, no, I'll skip the first two because they're basically just a lot of the usual kind of crap that they read. The incredible untold story of the 2012 election so far is that Romney's run has been a shimmering pearl of perfect political hypocrisy. Try saying that one three times fast.
Yeah, there's a good one.
Which he somehow managed to keep hidden, even with thousands of cameras following his every move. And the drama of this rhetorical high wire act was ratcheted up even further when Romney chose his running mate, Representative Paul Ryan. And then they go into some more, you know, beating up the Ryan and Romney. But getting back to what the whole thing is about. Debt. If the Republican Party had a James Carville, this is what he would have said to win Mitt over in whatever late-night war room session led to the Ryan pick. It's the debt, stupid. This is the way to defeat Barack Obama, to recast the race as a Jeremiah against debt, something just about everybody who's ever gotten a bill in the mail hates on a primal level. Last May, in a much-touted speech in Iowa, Romney used language that was literally inflammatory to describe America's federal borrowing. He said, a prairie fire of debt is sweeping across Iowa and our nation. Every day we fail to act, that fire gets closer to the homes and children we love. Our collective debt is no ordinary problem. According to Mitt, it's going to burn our children alive. And this is where we get to the hypocrisy at the heart of Mitt Romney. Now, everyone knows that he is fantastically rich, having scored great success, the legend goes, as a turnaround specialist, a shrewd financial operator who revived moribund companies as a high-priced consultant for a storied Wall Street private equity firm. But what most voters don't know is the way Mitt Romney actually made his fortune, by borrowing vast sums of money that other people were forced to pay back. This is the plain, stark reality that has somehow eluded America's top political journalists for two consecutive presidential campaigns. Mitt Romney is one of the greatest and most irresponsible debt creators of all time. In the past few decades, in fact, Romney has piled more debt onto more unsuspecting companies, written more gigantic checks than other people have to cover, than perhaps all but a handful of people on Earth. By making debt the centerpiece of his campaign, Romney was making a calculated bluff of historic dimensions, placing a massive all-in debt on the rank incompetence of the American press corps. The result has been a brilliant comedy. A man makes a $250 million fortune loading up companies with debt and then extracting million-dollar fees from these same companies in exchange for the generous service of telling them who needs to be fired in order to finance the debt payments he saddled them with in the first place. And that same man then runs for president, riding an image of children roasting on flames of debt, choosing as his running mate perhaps the only politician in America more pompous and self-righteous on the subject of evils of borrowed money than the candidate himself. Now, that's a really interesting couple of paragraphs, don't you think?
That is exceptional, especially for the Rolling Stone. I think that is. I mean, you know, it can be debated and everything, but one thing that's kind of an angle on that I thought of during the campaign was everybody says he's this great capitalist, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, if you look at the history of when he made all his money with these mergers and, you know, these takeovers and the reselling, it was very similar to the housing boom in that all the fiat money was going to these people that were doing these projects. You know, they're buying these companies and reselling them at a great profit. And so basically he did the same thing somebody would have done during the 2000 to 2007 with real estate. And, you know, if you can look at that as a great accomplishment or not. But, you know, that is a great way to, you know, I think that that's a very unique way to look at it. And I'd say, you know, that's worth the print just because of that angle.
It certainly pissed off Mark Vogel, I can tell you that.
Oh, I bet it did, because, you know, this guy was like a god to the conservatives.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And his big thing was that Obama, of course, is destroying the country through the debt, which
right,
we would agree with. And therefore, you had to support Romney because he was going to save us from going deeper into debt. And here I am presenting him with this article that says, well, not so much.
not so much. That's how he made his fortune. And, yeah, that's good. And the thing that got me the hypocritical aspect of it was how much money he spent during his speeches. And I think I mentioned that before, but he spent trillions. You know, the obvious one is defense, but there was no end to Romney, I think, actually spent more money during the debate and during the speeches than Obama, you know, in the future, than Obama did. And, you know, that doesn't mean one or the other would spend more money, but, you know, just the promises were just in the trillions and trillions. And there's no way you can go in and say, I'm going to cut the deficit, I'm still going to sustain all these programs, and on and on. And he was hypocritical. I mean, all politicians at that level are, but he was exceptional, I think.
Well, he was particularly good at it.
He was particularly good at it, right?
Yeah, exactly. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that he also tried to throw a bone, if you will, to the Ron Paul supporters when he said that he was in favor of not only auditing the Fed, but actually creating a commission to explore the possibility of going back on the gold standard.
Oh, really?
I didn't catch that one. Oh, yeah, yeah, that was, and not too many people fell for it with the Ron Paul revolution. They could see right through it.
Yeah, exactly.
But nevertheless, he did try to win their votes over that way. And what's particularly funny about it is when you look at this and you realize he's totally a fiat money man, because his entire business was based on debt-based money, on money that was created out there so he could, you know, borrow it and on behalf of companies. And it wasn't even money he had to pay back. It was money that the companies that he bought into had to pay back.
Yeah, well, the people that, and not putting down everybody that's rich, of course, but, I mean, you look at the people that have made the most money, and, you know, a lot of them do it. Most of them do it with other people's money. I mean, that's the whole idea. Like, what's the guy who had raised the income tax on the rich guy, on the rich people guy? Oh, God, I forgot. You know, one of the richest people in the world that advised Obama to raise the upper end of the income tax.
Oh, yeah. Not Beatty, the other one.
The
Democratic version. I can't think what his name is.
Yeah, the Democratic version. Well, his whole thing was making money on the float in insurance, which is basically he started this huge insurance company, and which wouldn't be possible in a free market because insurance would be more competitive. And the float, you know, I'm sure you know, Walt, is the difference between the premiums paid in and what goes out for their costs and what they have to pay for when people get hurt or whatever the insurance is. And, you know, he took that money and he started investing it, which was a unique idea at the time. Now they all do it, but, you know, he made his money. He made a fortune on that, and, you know, that's how money is made for the most part. I mean, there are a lot of people make money producing things, but, you know, we shouldn't discount that. But, you know, a lot of the money is made like Romney did, and I guess you could hold him up as a hero if that's, you know, your inclination. You know, it's a free country, right?
Well, semi-free.
It's free enough to where you can do that.
But the point is, this is a guy who lives and breathes using other people's money through a fiat monetary system that creates oodles of it so that people like him can come along and use that money.
Yep.
And the idea that he's going to actually take a stance to put a limit on that money supply by backing a gold standard is just plain laughable.
Pretty crazy. And I'm really – well, I'm not surprised he said that, because he said so many crazy things. And in the end, I think Obama used it well, you know, politically, and I'm not going into issues or anything, against Romney, where he started calling him on everything, and it took the heat off of Obama's record and, you know, Obama himself, and people started questioning Romney, because he changed his positions, and like you say, he promised everybody everything. I think
Obama had to do that because he bumbled so badly in the first debate. I mean,
wasn't that
Romney? Got to give Romney credit. He came after Obama on Obama's failures in the first debate, and Obama,
I was shocked. Now, I didn't watch the debate, but I read some of the outtakes from it. I was shocked how unprepared he was. I mean, I thought his advisor would have been better prepared than that.
He appeared to be asleep. I mean, he just didn't respond. It was something. You know, I was surprised too. You know, even if he would have been sharp, because that was Romney's best debate. If he would have been sharp at that, it would have been a draw. But and then he kind of made up for it in the last, you know, the other two debates, especially the last one where he looked like he was a bulldog kind of. But that first one, he almost almost blew the election there, I think.
Well, I don't think he could have blown the election.
You don't think so?
No, because ultimately, here's the big problem with the Romney candidacy in particular and the Republican approach these days in general. And it actually has a number of different facets to it, so just give me a moment to go over them. But the major problem is that Romney, first of all, and was a reflection of all of the Republican candidates, and all the Republican candidates were running on one platform. That platform is Obama is terrible.
Right, right.
Now, that can work. That kind of approach can work when you're not running against an incumbent. But when you're running against an incumbent, you're running against somebody who already has an established coalition. And it's an established coalition that got him a majority of the vote last time around.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to defeat him, you either have to come up with more people who didn't vote and get them to vote for you, plus the people who did vote for your guy the last time, or you have to take votes away from the incumbent. You're not going to take votes away from the incumbent by saying the incumbent's terrible, because the people who voted for him in the first place liked him for some reason. They're not going to stop liking him because things didn't go right. They may feel disappointed by him, but they're not going to stop disliking him. They're just not going to go that way.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of running a campaign on I'm not Obama is a lunacy. It's just, it makes no sense. I mean, put aside the issues. Put aside, you know, what Obama did in his first 4 years and what Romney did in Massachusetts and so forth. Just from a purely political, strategic point of view, it's lunacy to try to take down an incumbent based on I'm not the incumbent.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The other thing that was kind of wore very thin was, I think people, even as dense as they can be, as far as political issues, they started to see through, you know, after the repetitive speeches and points that everything was Obama's fault in the last 4 years. You know, I mean, they have a bad memory, but nobody has forgotten what happened, you know, right before the last election. And, you know, and I think all the thing, you know, he was bringing not only economy, but, you know, the Middle East is terrible since Obama took over. You know, it was just got so repetitive that people stopped buying it, except for his, you know, his own coalition.
Oh, right. Exactly. The only way that Romney could have capitalized on Obama's stumbles in that first debate was if he actually had his own personal agenda, his own ideas that actually coalesced into something that people could, you know, sink their teeth into.
Well, he was going to tell us all to us after he got elected.
Yeah, he went to school in the Richard Nixon approach to how to win
the Nixon approach. You know, you saw the foreign policy debate. I thought that was fairly hilarious in that they just sat there and agreed for an hour and a half. I mean, the only difference was Obama was saying we should do these exact same things, but we should speak a little softer about them. And Romney was like, well, we should do the exact same things that you're doing, but we should be really mean when we talk about it. And it was just hilarious. I mean, I don't know what they didn't agree on as far as foreign policy, which is a sad thing.
Actually, I didn't watch that debate, believe it or not. I knew it was going to be something that would put you to sleep, so I figured if I want to be asleep, I might as well just be in bed. So I just went to bed.
Yeah, they went on and on agreeing. Just, you know, it was the manner they argued about. And Romney was this, you know, big tough guy. I'm going to talk really tough to all these countries and do the same thing. And Obama was saying, no, we should talk softly. But, you know, they both have the same policy, which is basic intervention and, you know, the United States is the dominant military force, and you should use that to your advantage, you know, USA this and that. So, you know,
There was one good thing that came out of that, out of the foreign policy debate, now the fact that Obama got elected. Apparently, on election night after Obama, it was pretty clear he had won the thing and Romney had conceded and so forth, Obama took a call from Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, And apparently the way that Netanyahu congratulated him made clear to everyone listening in on the call that he was really disappointed that Romney didn't win.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I can see that. I can see that. I mean, but they, you know, they say, they were saying the same thing, but yeah, Romney was a lot, you know, tougher and a lot more pro-Israel about it. So, you know, I don't know. I'm sure he interprets that as having, you know, he'd rather have that guy in just because of the way they look at things. So,
which shows just how sick the whole relationship is between the U.S. and Israel, that, that the Israeli leader, it's not enough that the U.S. be considered an ally. It must be a strong ally who's willing to go to war on anything. If I'm going to give Obama something, I'm going to give him that, well, at least he hasn't gone quite that far.
Well, I tell you the
truth. I'll give him that much.
Yeah, I agree. And I basically made the decision on who would be least likely to take us to war. And it was a tough call, but I don't think it was a hard decision to make. But
well, it was an easy decision for me to make because I ended up voting for my wife because I knew she wouldn't take us to war.
At least not outside the house, right?
No, actually, she's really great.
There you go.
We don't even have skirmishes. It's wonderful.
Oh, well, that's what we need in the political scene in the world, I think.
I mean, the biggest skirmish is, what are we going to have for dinner?
Yeah, there you go. Well, it is over, and I'm glad it is, and I hope we never become a swing state.
You know, you listeners may know that you and Jake and Bill, when they're on, always send me your headlines for the day, and that way I know, you know, what to call on during our conversations here. And you sent me a headline that I thought was really interesting. You said, "Electoral divide grows and battleground states shrink." What did you mean by that?
Well, it was an actual article, and what they're saying is, as you go back in time, for instance, the first thing it mentions is the razor-thin 1960 presidential election at John Kennedy. John Kennedy campaigned in all 49 states, while Richard Nixon only visited all 50. And so, you know, now, I mean, they're just totally forgetting about a lot of the states because they're already decided. And so the battleground states have really shrunk the amount of them. And down to, I don't know how many did they say they had now, 10 or? And
well, let's see. There were, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, yeah, 10. Looks like 10. That's right.
Yeah. And it used to be quite a few.
I'm just looking at the map. They now had online, they had these interactive maps where you could make your own predictions about, you know, who's going to win which state. I'm looking at the map I put together where I got it right. I got 50 out of 50. And I was counting up the ones that were originally marked as toss-up states because that's how you knew which ones to, you know, to go after in terms of who you're going to pick. Which makes it pretty easy because, I mean, 40 of the states are already picked for you.
I think that's pretty good. If you can pick the 10, you know, that's pretty
good. It was difficult. I mean, because literally, with the exception of Florida and, let's see, Colorado? No. With Florida. With the exception of Florida, all you had to do was look at the averages for the polls in those swing states and you would get it right.
Yeah, and Florida was a tough one, and I didn't really think Ohio. You know, they made the big thing about Ohio, but I didn't even think that was going to be. Well, it was close, but not a big deal. But the interesting thing about this article that I don't agree with is what they say is, you know, they mention that the coasts are solidly Democratic and interior states are solidly Republican, and they mention that they believe people have been moving. You know, that's a prime consideration in moving, and I think that's just preposterous, you know, that people are going to move to a state solely because it's left or right. I mean, that's just goofy, although I'm sure some people do, but...
Well, they're the free staters. The free staters moved to New Hampshire.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
But I'm not sure that really ties into what you were saying. Sorry.
Well, that's... Yeah, you got that. You know, why... you know, they mentioned California, I think, as previously being a state that was always in dispute. You know, you never knew which way it would go. And, you know, a lot of these states used to be fought over, you know, just to the very end, and they aren't anymore. So it's an interesting, and it's kind of an urban-rural divide, too. I mean, it's that way in our state here. just in Oregon itself, you know, the rural areas tend to be more conservative, and the urban area, Portland, and the cities tend to be more liberal. But I don't know. There's just it's an interesting. The whole thing is kind of funny the way it is. It's I don't know if it's so much divided or it's just the media playing it out or what.
Well, let's explore a little bit after the break on that one, because we're about halfway through the show and we normally take a break around this time, so we can explore it afterward. And we're also going to talk about the fiscal cliff and a couple of other things of interest, including a very funny story about gold in New York City as a result of Hurricane Sandy going underwater and how this was a potential catastrophe. You're going to love this one. But anyway, we'll take a break and be right back. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back.
Talking about a revolution sounds.
And we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Walt and Gene here on this Thursday, November 8th. And if my voice sounds a little bit different from the way it did about 2 minutes ago, that's because I got knocked off wine. I normally call in via the internet, and my internet just disappeared. So, Gene, I now have a tinnier voice as a result because I'm having to call in by phone.
I know. It almost sounds clearer.
It sounds clearer? Oh, well.
But it's a little bit louder.
Okay. Well, then you never really know.
You never know.
But getting back to what we were talking about before the break, the thing that I also want to touch on regarding the Republican Party is that it isn't just a question of how their candidate, Romney, and in fact all the candidates were running, with the exception of Ron Paul, were all pushing the idea that I'm not Obama. It's also the fact that and this is something that one of the commentators on one of the election channels pointed out that I hadn't really noticed. I don't know if you've noticed this. Since 1988, there's not a single Republican who's gotten more than 50.5% of the vote.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Now, to be fair, the Democrats have only done it a couple times, and both times it was Obama. But nevertheless, nobody's getting even 51% of the vote on the Republican side. And there may be a very good reason for this. The reason that I'm pointing to is that Romney pointed his campaign at trying to win over the coalition between conservative, socially conservative Republicans and neoconservatives. And the whole, it's the Karl Rove theory. If you can get that group to come out for you, you can win an election. The problem with that theory is they are declining as a percentage of the overall population.
Yes, they are.
So you have Obama, whose coalition was primarily single women, the young, and minorities. And that coalition came out for him 4 years ago, and it came out for him again today, and both times it put him over 50%. Well, an approach that is based on going for the old Karl Rove theory doesn't work anymore.
And it's going to work even less as the years go on.
That's right, which raises the question, at what point do the conservatives in the party, particularly the Tea Party conservatives, at what point do they recognize that? Because until they recognize that, I mean, the Tea Party, I think, is probably going to keep going on. I don't think they're totally defeated by all this, but they're up against a wall there. Because unless they can find more people on the conservative side willing to register and come out to vote than they've already been getting, they're running a losing approach.
I think you're right. And the problem with the conservative, when we speak of conservative, the conservative, politically conservative, is they're not good at listening.
No.
And, you know, I notice this, you know, being that we don't come from either perspective. When I talk to
come to the sliver in the middle. That's where we come from.
Yeah, way out of space. But when I talk to conservative people and liberal people, there's a vast difference. This isn't true of all of them, but there more liberal people will listen to you and try to understand your position and look at it that way than conservative people. And the more conservative they are as far as neoconservative, the worse it is. Because, you know, basically you get far enough out in neoconservatism, it's a form of fascism as far as I'm concerned. But so that's going to be a huge problem, because at what point, like you say, do they start listening? And then the question is, what do they do? You know, this is an old party that basically represents to put it bluntly, rich white people and the, you know, industrial business interests. And you know, we're not saying, of course, the Democrats don't, you know, represent the industrial business interests, et cetera, but, or rich people. But
well, they wouldn't survive if they didn't.
Yeah, exactly. The thing is, at what point do they realize, you know, do they have to get like 30% of the vote or... But, you know, so far it's still been close. I mean, you have to put, like you mentioned, they're both at just around the 50% mark. So.
But this is, I think, tipping point territory. This is where things start moving more and more toward the Democratic side and less, you know, more and more away from the conservative Republican side.
And you have to ask yourself, if you can't beat, like they mentioned, you know, when Obama won, he won at the highest unemployment rate, the highest accepted by the government standards unemployment rate since Roosevelt. And if you can't beat that guy, you know, not but Obama in particular, but, you know, a guy who's operating during the highest unemployment rate, you know, who are you going to beat?
And the thing that really gets me is that at the Republican National Convention, now, of course, the Ron Paul Republicans were there. They were trying to gain a foothold, and there was the whole Ron Paul strategy and so forth. They were basically just trying to do what they could to take over the party. The Rules Committee and the chairman of the convention and so forth basically issued rulings that disenfranchised most of them, including those who had actually won delegate spots. And as one of the spokesmen for the Ron Paul campaign noted, I believe his name is John Tate, he said he was stunned and shocked by the decision, and his reply at the time was to himself, he didn't say it to anybody, but he thought in his head was, well, that's it for the Romney campaign. Now, this was, you know, months before the actual election, but he was making a very valid point. If you're going to have any kind of change within the Republican Party, it has to come from your new young upstarts coming up through the channels. You shut those people off, you're shutting off your future.
Well, that's, you know, another thing that's traditional. The Republicans have traditionally been exclusive. It's an exclusive party that convinces the public that they're not exclusive, and that's how they get elected. Where, on the other hand, with all their faults, the Democrats are much more inclusive of different social groups, you know, trying to bring people in and et cetera, with legislation or promises. And, you know, when you, now I don't know if political libertarians would have any more success on the Democratic side, but I kind of doubt if they would get the rules changed to exclude them. You know, I wouldn't see that. You know, they may get ignored.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if the Democrats try to pull something similar. Maybe not as overt as what the Republicans do.
Well,
but they'd find some way to shut them out if they could.
Yeah, you know,
you don't
want
to be embarrassed in your public display on national TV, you know?
Yeah.
That's really the way it is.
I don't know what there's that debate about which side the political libertarians fit in better, and I don't know what the answer to that is.
Well, neither one, I don't think.
neither one. Now that probably is the answer.
It's lonely in the middle, but on the other hand, you feel good about yourself.
Yeah. Hopefully you can convince a couple people along the way.
Well, we spent two-thirds of the show on the election. We should probably touch on the news a little bit, don't you think? Because this is the Freedom News Hour. We should probably just, you know, maybe spend a minute or two on it. So let me just do a little quick flight over a couple of headlines. First of all, news came out of the Eurozone regarding two of the major banks tied up in the LIBOR manipulation scheme. One of them is about Barclays Bank. It appears, well, I'll just read this from New York Times. This is a November 5th article entitled "A Triple Whammy for Barclays." 4 months after reaching a $453 million settlement with American and British regulators over manipulating the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is seeking a $435 million civil penalty over accusations that the bank manipulated energy prices in and around California. And the bank has also disclosed that the Justice Department and the Securities and Exchange Commission are examining whether payments related to raising capital from investors in the Middle East during the height of the financial crisis violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So Barclays having a little fun there, to say the least. And then also coming out this week on the same day, the Royal Bank of Scotland said it expects to pay a fine in the coming months to settle regulators' probes again into allegations the lender tried to manipulate LIBOR. whether the penalty exceeds the record £290 million, $467 million Barclays paid in June or not, it will still be a miserable day in RBS's history, according to Chief Executive Officer Stephen Hester. That's what he told him on a call on November 2nd. RBS is one of more than a dozen banks worldwide facing regulatory probes into allegations that they manipulated the LIBOR rate. So LIBOR continues to move along, and we're continuing to see more and more banks dragged into it. Now, the next question is, what's going to be the next bank, probably a non-UK bank, that's going to be dragged into it? I don't know the answer to that one. Do you have any clues on
it? Yeah, that's an interesting question, and, you know, whether it was just centered in that country or just was a common practice.
No, we know it's not centered there. It's just a question of how much they're going to bring out. That's all.
Yeah, and you know, are they just doing this to slap some wrists, you know, and then move on? And it's really incredible that people actually have that much power, I think. And you know, and it's supposed to be in the private sector, right?
Yeah, so-called, right?
So-called private sector, so...
Well, of course, the thing that really drives the whole thing is the money supply and the fact that it's an elastic money supply and that it's controlled by the central banks at the behest of the government. So when you have that, you're going to have things like LIBOR manipulation. It's just going to be part and parcel because with that kind of manipulation, it's impossible to have a healthy economy. I mean, you're ultimately going to disrupt the economy one way or another. And when those disruptions occur, you have to have some way to try to convince the markets that they aren't really happening. You manipulate this, manipulate that, and, you know, you manipulate precious metals, you manipulate LIBOR and mortgages, you manipulate oil, you manipulate all of them so that the markets never get the idea that things are falling apart.
Yeah, and it brings up an interesting political question. You know, people who argue, where does a free market start, or where does a political influence end? And you know, you find conservatives arguing, you know, the banks are private sector and all this. To me, that much influence, it's just not private sector anymore. I mean, this is public. They're basically part. You know, you take away the government, and like you mentioned, all the things you mentioned, the money production, the distribution. These companies, you know, would just kind of shrivel up and die.
Well, they'd be a lot smaller than they are. That's for
they'd
sure.
be a lot smaller than they are, yeah.
Yeah. Now, another interesting story that came out this week, and this is the one that was the funny one I alluded to earlier. Normally, I'd save the funny one for the end, but I just can't. I can't resist. I got to get this one in now. This came out of Bloomberg, and it's a... It's a sad story because, of course, it's related to Hurricane Sandy, and there's been a whole lot of misery related to that. Misery that is compounded now in the Northeast with a nor'easter snowstorm that blew through yesterday. So, you know, there are a lot of people who are really suffering severely. But this is a funny side to the story because, according to Bloomberg, they put out an article that's entitled "About That Gold Stored in Flood-Prone Lower Manhattan." And I'll just read a little bit of it to you. It says, as New York City continues to dry out in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, the financial world is reconsidering just how smart it is to place critical pieces of infrastructure in flood-prone areas. Citigroup's waterlogged building at 111 Wall Street will be unusable for several weeks, and two critical Verizon communications facilities suffered extensive flooding during the storm. And that has been very severe because it's affected people who have noticed, for instance, difficulty with the internet or phone calls dropping or whatever. Chances are it's tied to that. But getting on with the article. Now, at least the material in those sites is replaceable. That's the funny part. What about the nearly 15 million pounds of gold bricks stored at the New York Fed? Well, they're safe and will be, in theory, should floodwaters return. The bullion is so heavy that its vault sits 80 feet below street level and 50 feet below sea level on the bedrock beneath Manhattan. Though the bank's fortress-like building is located far downtown, close to where other financial institutions sustained water damage, the property at 33 Liberty Street sits in the city's evacuation zone C, where residents are told to expect storm surge flooding only from major Category 3 or 4 hurricanes that hit the New York Harbor. The New York Fed is tight-lipped about how it secures the planet's largest concentration of gold, referring questions on the subject to a brochure published on its website. The pamphlet claims that the vault is protected by an airtight and watertight seal created by lowering a 90-ton steel cylinder just 3/8 of an inch into a 140-ton steel and concrete frame, an effect similar to pushing a cork down into a bottle. Other security measures include closed-circuit video feeds, firearms training for guards, and the weight of the gold itself. At 27 pounds a bar, it's hard to smuggle one out in a pocket. The bank's security arrangements are so trusted by depositors that few, if any, have ever tried to do anything about it. All right, so that's the setup for it. Now, here's the quirker, if I can. My computer is giving me a hard time, so bear with me for a second here. That obviously has helped to fuel, That obviously has helped to fuel a string of conspiracy theories that the gold isn't really there, isn't really gold, or is otherwise suspect. The Los Angeles Times reported in August that the federal government was conducting its first ever audit of the bullion is stored beneath Liberty Street, drilling tiny holes into selected ingots and analyzing the metal. Now, ordinarily, you'd be able to eye the gold bars yourself. Some 25,000 visitors tour the bank's vault each year. But those visits, the bank says, have been canceled indefinitely due to the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy.
Huh. But they're not...
Now, let's see if we've got this straight. Seawater harms gold. Is that the idea? And so we can't show you the gold because the seawater will harm it.
Which, of course, it was protected before, they said.
Good.
Supposedly, it was watertight. Yet, I saw an interview, and they were talking about how we could prepare for other events like this on in our subways. And I was thinking, how exactly do you prepare a subway for a flood?
Well, you get everybody out is what you do.
Get everybody out. You can maybe get the trains out or something, but...
Well, you can't get the trains out, unfortunately, but...
Oh, so they weren't even able to remove the trains.
No, and actually, it was really quite remarkable. The MTA workers who basically spent 24 hours a day, you know, day after day, working to get the subways up and running. They got it up and running within, I think, 2 days after Sandy hit, which was a phenomenal effort because
it
was all flooded. The whole subway was flooded, and they were able to pump it all out and get the trains up and running. I mean, that was kudos to them, to the people who, you know, the thousands of people who worked for the MTA, because they did a great job getting that city back on its feet.
Now, would the trains themselves flood? I mean, they're down there. It's full of water, right? Or there had to be at least a lot of water down there.
I imagine that that was a serious problem. And I think they do have a place where they can store the trains overnight and so forth that may or may not be above the flood line. I'm not sure what the details are. But the bottom line is they got the trains moving, and that's all we really have to worry about. I mean, that to me anyway. I mean, they obviously have a lot more to worry about than that. But to me, that's the big thing.
Yeah, infrastructure, like Salem, Oregon, which is the capital, I did a lot of commercial work when I was there, and they had quite a few. I mean, I don't even know how many, but these underground tunnels, underground offices, underground parking areas, and they're all connected to the capital, and they seal, you think of a street which collects water when it's raining, and it rains a lot here, and they're all sealed. They have to be sealed and protected from this water that's just flowing above them. And, I can't imagine the cost.
It's a job. There's no doubt about that.
Yep.
Well, we've got about, looks like 7 minutes left, and we've got two articles. Don't know if we can get them through in that time, but we'll give it a shot. One, you did a little research on the KBR case with the National Guardsmen, and that has turned out to be quite a bit of justice for the National Guardsmen, although was it really enough? What did you find out?
Well, KBR, which is one of the big defense contractors during the Bush-Iraqi war, and basically they're saying that they knew a hazardous chemical was present at an Iraqi water treatment plant even before arriving there. And this is what one of the jurors said. On Friday, they awarded $85 million in damages to 12 soldiers. But the defense contractor allowed the soldiers and employees to work there for months before dealing with the contamination. I'll read some from the article. It is such a strong case of negligence, said Jim Czar. KBR officials knew about it but said nothing to the soldiers who were protecting them at Kwarmat Ali. All they had to do was talk to them. Let's see, it goes on to say... the chemical was sodium dichromate, which is the single most significant document, said it was present before they arrived there. They were aware of it. The jurors saw that KBR had referenced it as early as November 2002, which is 4 months before contractors first reached the area, soon after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. It was on to say work at the plant wasn't shut down until late in the summer after the soldiers, and many of them were from Oregon, by the way, many other troops and contractors had spent time at the site. The they used a standard information sheet, which talks about materials used at the construction sites and other projects. It goes on for sodium dichromate. This is what the description read. Very hazardous in case of skin contact, irritant, sensitizer of eye contact, irritant of ingestion, hazardous in case of skin contact, corrosive of eye contact, corrosive of inhalation, lung irritant. Prolonged exposure may result in skin burns, ulcerations, overexposure by inhalation may cause respiratory irritation. Severe overexposure can result in death. So they were obviously aware of it. And the same guy goes on to say, the question is the Army negligent? He said, yes, they are 100%, but you can't sue the Army. So there's because of the longstanding legal doctrine that prevents troops from suing the military for harm they suffer while serving. So it's they did decide in favor of the soldiers and against the contractor. So I imagine a legal situation where the Army did the same thing, there would be nothing you could do, which is kind of a sad state of affairs.
Oh, definitely. Now, what was the time period when all of these events took place?
They said they first knew about it in, let's see, what was it here? As early as November 2002, that was 4 months before contractors reached the area. They had already received that document, and the company knew about it, and then they closed it down. I'm trying to find that there.
Well, that's right. You answered the main part of the question. So you've confirmed that basically this was happening while KBR was a part of Halliburton.
Yes, yes.
And that's a key point because, of course, Halliburton has for years claimed that we do nothing wrong, and, well, it turns out they did do something wrong.
Yeah, well, they did plenty wrong. And, then, you know, they have good lawyers, and so when it does go this direction, you know that it's an obvious thing. Like this guy said, it was obvious negligence, and it sure sounds like it. I mean, they had all the paperwork right there, and you know, anytime it's a close case, usually the side with the big money lawyers are going to come up ahead. But this was pretty obvious, and you know, at least it's good they got a settlement.
That is good, and if only that kind of thing happened more often so that the people who are harmed by the powers that be, that would be a better thing. I don't
have
a whole lot of hope, but still.
We would have a working legal system, wouldn't we?
That'd be something. Well, we've got just a few minutes left, just time enough for our last article, and it ties into the election cycle, which, of course, you know, makes a nice way to round off the show about the election. The issue now that Obama's been reelected and that Congress is basically the way it was before, there's not a whole lot of change in the House and the Senate in terms of the overall makeup, other than the fact that Ron Paul won't be there anymore. But now that all that election stuff is done, the next item on all the politicians' agendas is what to do about the fiscal cliff that we've been facing since the summer of 2011. And that fiscal cliff, of course, refers to the compromise that was reached that year, which was a compromise that satisfied no one and actually solved nothing, but did lead to a situation we're facing now where some taxes that had been pulled down, we're going to go back up, and there are going to be some cuts in spending that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans really wanted to see. And yet, despite all of this, most pundits are saying they don't expect anything to actually get constructively done between now and the end of the year when all these things take place. So my question to you, Gene, is what do you think? Is this going to be something where, despite all of their best wishes, if you will, I don't know if I should call them best, but all of their wishes, that all the king's horses and all the king's men can't fix this fiscal cliff, or fix us from going over the fiscal cliff?
Well, you would think some of the, you know, it's the same players, you would think some of the pressure is off. I mean, I think this whole the Republicans basically were forming a blockade in the name of the election, and so, you know, they haven't come out on top from doing that, and you know, hopefully they can get together and figure something out. I think the sticking point may still be the tax rate at the quarter of a million and above level. So it's going to be something to see what they can come up with, because most of the Republicans still say they're against that, and Obama is very determined to get that over. you know, I don't understand why they can't. You know, to me, I would say, well, okay, let's keep the same rate and take away the deductions and the loopholes at that level. You can do the same thing, you know, just kind of engineer it differently. But we'll have to see. I would think they're in a better situation just because the election is over and that pressure is off. But that's just my opinion.
Well, the point you raised about taking away the loopholes, that's actually been proposed, and that's where the conservatives really cry holy heck, saying no, we don't want that, because they want to have those loopholes, because that's how they write off so many of their taxes, and from their perspective, and understandably so, it would result in a much larger tax increase than an actual tax rate increase.
Well, yeah, I think that's going to be the point they're going to argue about. And, of course, they got a lot more than that to argue about when you think about it. I mean, it's the entire budget they're concerned with, really, and where they're going to spend money and how the deficit, and that's a huge thing. And so it's possible that, I don't know, the fiscal cliff thing goes in. I mean, we've talked about the effect it would have on the economy, you know, just the size of the contribution by the federal government into the economy, and you know, that would be drastically cut back. I don't know drastically, but it would definitely be cut back. So, yeah, that's going to be a tough one. But they got time. They should do something with their...
Well, they may have time, but we don't. Unfortunately, yeah. We're done for this hour. But, Gene, as usual, it's been a pleasure.
Fun show.
Absolutely. We'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Oh, no.